Are you interested in improving your procurement and negotiation skills and understanding? Well, this is the podcast for you. The Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the latest Procurement Podcast with myself, Andy Franks from Bright Sky Care Mind, and my colleague, Christoph Barrière-Vajou.
Good morning, good afternoon, whatever time zone you are on. Yeah, the pronunciation is getting better and better, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And Christoph runs BVW Global and has a very long and extensive and successful career in procurement. And I'm delighted to welcome a guest onto the podcast today, all the way from, is it sunny England or is it quite cold and miserable over there, Paul?
It's actually a very nice day here today. We've got one of those rare September mornings. It's beautiful.
So have you made a little tick on the calendar? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So Paul is Paul McCarthy, currently Managing Director for SEA Graphic Paper UK Limited. And Paul's got a wide-ranging career on both sides of the procurement fence, predominantly in the magazine, print, paper trade. But perhaps if I could hand over to you, Paul, just to give a little bit of a potted CV, because you never know who might be listening.
Thanks, Andy. Well, we've followed quite similar paths, certainly earlier on in our career, Andy, haven't we? We both started off in the postroom of national magazines at the tender age of 19. Worked my way through the company there as production controller on Harper's and Queen magazine. Left there for a year and went to Northern and Shell to launch OK magazine and look after 46 porn titles. That lasted a very healthy 11 months and learned a lot how not to do things. Then went back to National Magazines and Hearst to manage Cosmopolitan magazine. And then from there, I was the commercial manager and buyer at Condé Nast. So buying print, paper and repro for Vogue, Tatler, GQ, all those sort of titles. I did that for about 5 years. And then in 2004, I looked at the landscape and thought, well, where can I go from here? And there wasn't too many places on the procurement side of the magazines that I could go from there. So I jumped ship and went poacher turned gamekeeper, or the other way around, and joined Embriel as a sales director and sold paper to Vogue and all the magazines and that sort of thing. Then Sappi bought Embriel, and I went with those guys, carried on with them. And then 4 years ago, I joined SCA UK as managing director, and here we are now. 2 weeks ago, SCA announced that they were converting the paper machines into pulp machines, therefore effectively closing down that part of the business and reopening it up in a very different side of the industry, but still servicing the forest, because SCA own about 8% of Sweden with a huge forest. I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic company. Very sustainable, very clean. It's just a shame that they decided that paper wasn't the future for them. So that's where we are now. But, well, I'm just clearing that side up.
Well, very comprehensive run through. And as we've alluded to, you've been on both sides of the fence from a procurement perspective. And so it's a regular question that I like to get out of the way quite early on is how, or effectively, as far as you're concerned, you know, what is procurement? How is it? And are there some examples that you've seen of it evolving or not evolving? First and foremost, what is procurement?
There's always a moment of silence here every time you ask that question, Andy.
Yeah, there's always a pause where you go, shall I tell the truth?
Paul, I'm buying you time here by making a joke here, so you have time to think about it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm back at school now. What is procurement? Yeah. Sort of that kid in the class. I'm not great at answering those sort of questions what is procurement, because I think it's many different things to different people. But from my perspective, it's about buying products and buying things for your company in a way that is effective. And effective doesn't mean cheap. It doesn't mean it's got to be the best. It's got to be the best for your company. And that also has got to tick many different boxes. The best for right now, the best for the future. And certainly in our industry, I think you've got to have one eye on the future, which is a big, big problem that I'm seeing and have seen over the past 10 years, is that most people don't seem to have that eye on the future. Where the industry's in decline, their concentration has only been 6 months ahead. And I think even now, with the COVID and everything else, that's dropped down to 3 months. There's been a huge knowledge gap in the industry. And I think it goes back to about 2008, when 2009, when we had the financial crisis. And all the baby boomers that were trained and did their apprenticeships and learnt their craft. So on the buying side, they would have learnt in magazines about print, about paper, about magazines, and they would have done their proper apprenticeships. They'd have gone to paper school. All these guys were on a fairly healthy salary, so they got made redundant or exited from the industry, and they promoted up these young people into these positions, and they dumped departments on other departments and put them into accounts, and then they started looking at spreadsheets and, you know, buying via Excel. And that went on for quite a while. And while there was an abundance of paper and an abundance of print, that could be done relatively easy. So if you fast forward 10 years to 2019, 2020, you start looking now. These guys have been in that job for 10 years plus. So in their minds, they're extremely experienced. They've done the position, they've done the job for 10 years now. They know what they're doing, but they've never bought in a hard market. It's always been a very soft market. So once the supply-demand differentiation got too big and the market started to correct itself, and we started closing down mills left, right, and center and taking out capacity, and even, you know, 3-4 years ago, we started telling people, look, this is the way it's going. And they're saying, yeah, but the demand is still declining. Yeah, but we're closing down huge mills and lots of them. And it's like, okay. And they're still just buying as cheap as they can and driving the price down, which is expediting the decline in the capacity, because obviously no one was making any money. And then with COVID come along, it's expedited the whole process by about 3 to 5 years, I'd say.
Oh, wow.
To a point. So when they announced the closure of SCA mill on that day, also UPM announced the closure of another mill. So that was 1.5 million tons taken out of the industry in one day.
Wow.
From a 6 million ton industry for that particular area. So it's now starting to scare people, I think. And the problem is that their choice is going as well, because lots of the smaller mills are struggling massively around Europe and applying for loans from the government and that sort of thing. But there's only one way. You know, these are zombie companies. They're just trotting along. So there's only going to be 2 or 3 mills left that's going to surface these guys.
This is nothing new in terms of, you know, the paper printing declining. I mean, this has been coming for a long, long time. And you do mention, you know, the outlook was, you know, 6 months, 12 months. Well, the paper has been, you know, people reading newspaper, reading magazine has been declining for a lot longer than that. What was the issue as to why this was not better planned back then? And it's almost now it's down to the wire, and it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction where you have to close things down, it seems like.
I think from the supply side, there's a phrase that absolutely kills me, and every time I hear it, my teeth grind. And it's from sales guys that say, "Well, the industry will see me out," and that is just so annoying. And it reflects that there's still on the sales side quite a few of the older generation there, and they're just looking; they've got one eye on their retirement. But in reality, there's still a big chunk of industry there. There's still big business there. There's still magazines. There's still catalogs. There's still new industry popping up using paper. And that's what I've been trying to do in the past 4 years, looking for everything and anything that's not magazine publishing, because that stuff ticks over. That's fine. And there's certain areas of that works really well. The specialist publishing side is a very successful model because it targets the audience.
Yeah, it's about being able to achieve that paradigm mindset change where people are, yeah, you may not read Vogue, as much as before, but you might need some other form of paper. And it's a matter of finding that niche.
And it's coming back in. You know, one of our biggest sales guys was an old man called David Attenborough. You know, when he did the wildlife series about plastic. You know, it was an absolute boost for us. And Greta Thunberg, a massive, another salesperson for us. And, you know, I've been using their clips in my sales side for our sustainability.
It's
gone complete circle. And, you know, one of the things I did, I sent a questionnaire out to all my sales guys and asked them to, did a bit of a competition and asked them to fill out as many things that they can think of that they can replace plastic with paper. And I said, don't ask your children, ask your parents, because we're almost going full circle back to the 60s, where, you know, if you go to the fishmonger, they're going to wrap the fish in paper, and the butchers and that sort of thing. They're kind of reverting back, and that trend's coming back quite quickly. So I think there's certainly an opportunity there going forward, without a doubt, without a doubt.
Absolutely. And you see that all over the place. And I think haven't the Sunday Times just started to wrap their supplements in paper as opposed to plastics?
But everyone, we've been looking at that for the past 2 years. Yeah,
and I think moving wider away from just from print and paper, I think one of the challenges procurement functions certainly face is keeping reality in the forefront of their decision making. And try and steer the there are two schools of management. There's the reality school of management, and then there's the spreadsheet school of management. Now sometimes they collide, but sometimes they're going very different directions. And also you've got the additional human layer on top of it, which is, oh, this industry will see me out. Who cares? And that's quite a lot of what the world is doing with. You know, with plastics and all the consumables that we're getting through, it's people saying, well, you know, it won't bother me and hopefully won't affect my children. But, you know, it will affect us. It will affect our children, grandchildren, more and more and more. And it's that thing that, where procurement, you know, has got a responsibility. And we've touched on this before, Christoph, about where procurement sits within an organization. Does it sit within the finance function as purely a transactional part of the business? And if so, aren't we missing a huge opportunity to actually say this should be within the strategic and strategy focused part of any organization? And you know, there's been a bigger push to get procurement out of the clutches of finance more front and center of every organization.
I think what Paul mentioned before, asking the team to think about ways of anything where plastic can be replaced with paper, brings a bit of a shift in the culture of the organization, where it becomes a collaborative effort to keep that organization alive and also to ensure that all the functions are working in sync toward the same end goal. And it may not be in the form of a magazine or a newspaper, but there's plenty, as you mentioned, Paul, plenty of users for paper in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you touched on that there as well, about getting the employees to buy into the concept and buy into the company, and everybody, regardless whether you're in accounts or internal or whatever, getting them to be responsible and feel part of that is a major thing, I think. And it really helps the whole company.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things, steps towards more holistic approach to business, where everybody within an organization should be able to sell that business to somebody they meet. They should be able to sell what the service is, what the product is, what the approach is, and so people get enthused by it and say, "Oh, I didn't know you did that. Are you a salesperson?" No, actually, I just work in IT, but I know about this business.
Exactly.
And it's also, everybody should be able to think along the sort of sustainable and more strategic line, and everybody within the organization should have input. And I think it varies from hemisphere to hemisphere and from country to country, because there's a different approach. And I just wanted to touch on this, unless you've got anything more to add specifically around this, Christoph, looking at the difference between working with, in the case of SEA, a Swedish company where, sustainability, is, first and foremost, it's been an absolute priority for, the majority of their existence, really. And certainly it's become, because, I remember people saying, "Oh, you buy paper, you're just chopping down all those trees," and then you explain that I got interrupted on the call there. I don't know if it came through to you.
No.
So it's that thing about sustainability is front and center for them. But do you find, working for a Swedish organization versus a UK organization, that there's a greater visibility around the challenges?
It's been strange, because we've only recently picked up on that, because the Swedish working, it was the norm. So when a Swedish guy walks through, from his house to the office, he's got trees on the left of him and lakes to the right of him. He doesn't think about anything else. And what we're trying to explain to is that they're quite unique in that. No, nobody else really sees that. In England, you've got roads and buildings all over the place. They don't get that there's lots of trees there and the forest is growing and it's a crop and whatnot. So education on both sides. So trying to get the Swedes to shout out about it a bit more, because for them, it's just a matter of course. The forest has been there for generations because the guy's grandfather and great-grandfather was planting trees while he was cutting down. It's very early sustainability. For them, it's just, that's what it is. But for some procurement guys in the UK and around the world, when you talk to them, they still think, paper comes from trees and trees come from the Amazon. And it's a bad thing because you're chopping these great big trees down. Education is the key here. And going back to the point, it's trying to get younger people into the industry and get younger people into buying positions and selling positions with a balanced, educated view. And that's I think, a job for us now, is to try and educate everybody, not only, the sales guys and the procurement guys, so that then they can educate their company.
And I certainly think from a broader procurement perspective, again, it's that the need for people to be specialists in their areas is important. I mean, when doing indirect procurement, and we touch on this in other podcasts, there's an element of the process which is pretty straightforward. But at the same time, you need to be able to understand what that specific area, the industry you're tapping into is looking like. For example, if you're doing, your travel procurement and putting your budgets together in January of this year, you would think, it's going to be a quite good year. There's going to be a fair bit of overseas travel. We'll do our deals with our preferred airlines, and then in March, that's not going to happen. Now, nobody could have foreseen the impact of COVID, but it's almost, I wonder how many businesses had a strategy, a risk strategy that to manage that from a procurement.
A disaster recovery plan. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I don't think there's many that do.
No.
That have.
The idea of the specialist, Andy and Paul, and having, you mentioned, Paul, the balanced, educated view. I think I cannot remember on top of my head which organization it was, but when you join, they will take you over the next 6 or 9 months to perform your function in different departments. So you will do a bit of marketing, you'll do a bit of sale, you do some procurement, you do some finance, so on and so forth, to get a bit of a broad view as to what your specialist role impacts. And I think when you mentioned, you know, a balanced educated view, it will be good for organizations to every 24 months or so, even though you are a specialist in procurement, that you do spend time in other areas outside of your area in order to increase the value to your specialty, I guess, to find ways to grow, I guess.
Yeah, and give you knowledge of your company. And you know, similarly, the guys that you're dealing with as well. You know, it's a great strength of mine, I think, is that I've sat on the other side of the table. I've sat in that procurement chair, but with a little bit more training than some of the guys that I'm talking to. And sometimes they're like scared rabbits in the headlight. They've got no idea what they're doing. They're just going, well, how much is it? How much is it? And that's it. I had a Zoom meeting the other day with one of the broadsheet newspapers. So this is their main thing. And again, they'd got rid of the procurement guys and it was dumped on another department. And these guys, there's six people there. And I asked them, does anybody know anything about paper? That was my opening gambit. To which the reply was no. How can that be? It's just phenomenal. And all they was trying to do was find out what the person that they just sacked did.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no foresight there. And bearing in mind, this is their core product. Just absolutely crazy. And it baffled me. It absolutely baffled me.
And within that organization, were there like regular training and regular, you know?
Nope.
None of that, huh?
Not recently. It's just cut.
And over time, this has a massive impact in continuation.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. But all that would do is expedite their decline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're going to buy really badly. They're going to make some crazy decisions that doesn't make any sense. But it'll look great on the spreadsheet for a few months. But, you know, going forward, it's not going to work.
And I think it comes back to the point you raised earlier about people's horizon used to be, you know, looking at a five-year strategy and a couple of organizations I used to work for, they had a brief, you know,
yeah.
Projecting beyond 5 years was pretty hard, but it was, you know, this is the 5-year plan.
Yeah.
And then this is the 3-year rolling budget. And yeah, but then more recently with businesses that I've been involved with, they're exactly as you said, Paul. They're down to well, this is what we'd like to achieve this year, but this is what our 3-month horizon looks like. Now, of course, in the case of our current shared global experience, that's sort of you know there's a validity to it, but at the same time, the strategic thinking that just limits everything to a three-month horizon is. It's quite limiting and doesn't, to my mind, doesn't strike a very positive note at all. And again, as you know, reiterating what you said, Paul, that I think they do, they will preempt their own demise by making these significantly short-term decisions. And people are having to make specific decisions at the moment, but you know, some countries are. Furloughing workforces for 12 months, some for 8 months, some for 2 years, you know, one would imagine that the people with a more long-term view might be the ones who will benefit. But
And it's also putting a value on the procurement side, because it's not they almost, you know, call it a cost center,
rather
than a cash generator. It's and they don't understand that you know, you can save so much money from that area. It's a very strange feeling that you get from some of these companies. Do you remember an old friend of ours, Andy, that was a big worked for a big publisher? It was a family-owned publisher that went back generations, very old school. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they didn't think too much of our friend there, and they just gave him procurement to deal with.
Yeah.
Because they thought he was the family idiot, and he used to laugh at them. He said, "It's crazy. They think I'm this idiot, and yet they've given me millions and millions of pounds of budget to spend."
Yeah.
He said, "You know, which one is the idiot?" Absolutely crazy. And I think that mentality has really pushed through even more in recent times. And going back to our very first statement, is that I think there's an extremely small percentage of procurement professionals and people in procurement positions that have a real understanding of their job and their suppliers' jobs and what their supplier can give them and what they should be doing for their company.
I think you're absolutely right. I think I've shared it before on here on the procurement podcast. You know, the opportunity and scope that and benefit that a well-supported procurement function can bring to a business is phenomenal, because particularly if they're given the boardroom support to make strategic decisions that aren't just stopgap ones to bolster a fading sales department, for example. So,
you know, exactly,
it's always that, you know, so we haven't managed to sell as many copies, so or we haven't managed to sell as many items of clothing, or we're not, you know, so and the first team to be hit or people to be hit will be the suppliers, as opposed to saying, actually, have we got the right creative director in place? You know, are the clothes that we're designing just ludicrous and nobody's going to buy them? Are these sunglasses just ridiculous and people aren't going to buy them? Or shall we just try and screw the supplier down? And coming back to the point, we hear quite a bit, Christoph, around the partnership piece and how it's all important that for procurement. And I do agree with the statement that procurement should be very closely aligned to their suppliers and their business model and their supply chain, and understand the implications. But we often, that's always a bit of a glib, seems to be a glib statement that, we want to be a partnership.
Yeah, and I think the focus is too much on the on the cost savings and the price reduction. I mean, I really like what you mentioned, Paul, about looking for ways to replace plastic with paper, which in a way is trying to find new niche revenue areas. And based on that, you know, price reduction is almost irrelevant if you find another pool of revenue, and if you work with your suppliers as well to identify those pool of revenues as well. Because, you know, everyone wins in the whole scheme of thing, and I think, you know, savings a few dollars here and there, yes, in a way that's almost the easy part. Finding new sources of revenue and new niche market and strategically addressing those is a bit more complicated. It's a bit more lengthy, but down the track, it's a lot more valuable to an organization and the livelihood of. The long-term viability of that organization. I think it's much more valuable long-term. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's completely more rewarded as well all round. It really is when you find new areas. I mean, we were supplying placemats for Wagamama's, which is a Japanese restaurant over here. I'm not sure around the world, but looking at things like that, paper to go into confectionery. On car seats, but just anything and everything that we can find that we can put paper onto, we were looking at, and it just makes it so much more interesting instead of a race to the bottom price.
There is a book that came out in the early 90s, Who Moved My Cheese. I think that book needs to be read by everyone. You know, it's about finding new opportunities and always looking for new opportunities.
That book was given to me. First day of joining EMAP was given to me by the CEO, and he made it his personal mission to make sure that every new manager came into an organization was given a copy of that. He said, "Want to know what EMAP's like? There you go, read that."
It's such a good book. I mean, it's easy to read, it's quick, and it's in a nutshell, it just teaches you everything about life, really, more than businesses too. Who Moved My Cheese? If you haven't read it, make sure you get a copy.
Well, we should start the procurement podcast book club and start because that's a way of shipping some paper sales. So yeah, well done.
I was thinking about a digital copy, Andy.
Oh, no, you don't want to do that, Chris. I think the learnings, you know, we've been fortunate on the podcast to have people in different spaces. We've had people from the Regional Fire Service in New South Wales and local government. We've also had people from the banking industry, and now Paul's experience with the magazine print publishing, broad paper, and sustainability. But it seems that once again, the same messages keep coming through, and hopefully it's not too tiresome for people to hear it, but the thing about having knowledge, understanding, and perspective of what can be done, and I think certainly businesses that think that things are going to be the same in 5 years' time as they are today, well, they won't be around in 5 years' time. It's as simple as that, and procurement is can be a very positive force for change, but we also see where it can be hampered, and also that procurement professionals themselves make the assumption that everything's going to be the same as it was 5 years ago in 5 years' time, and they find themselves outmaneuvered by circumstance, outmaneuvered by their competition, and outmaneuvered by their suppliers. I mean, Paul, have you got any examples where you've been confronted by such inept procurement function that no names, no patrol, but where you've been able to effectively make a really positive contribution to your business? In other words, a financial killing based on the fact that obviously you don't want to completely it would be very career limiting and business mm-hmm. limiting. If you completely stiffed your customer. But have you got any examples where you think they really got it wrong? Doesn't matter if you don't. But I just wonder if there's anything where you sort of thought, or has been situations where you think somebody's making such a bad decision, you have to correct them to the detriment of your own business.
Yeah, I mean. I've had to jump in their seat quite a lot in past years. And one of my biggest selling techniques in recent years is I can make you look good in front of your boss. I've done your job. I can help you. I can take that load off of you, and we'll walk you through this. But I mean, I think one of the biggest examples of devastation that I can see coming, and I think we're in the middle of it, is the example I gave you earlier on, where they'd literally got rid of all of their procurement guys without knowing exactly what they did, even down to the small detail of how they do the accounts, which part goes where. They made the person redundant without knowing their job, which is just mind-boggling. And then they asked them if they could write out a job spec for them before they go, and the answer was no, you've made the job redundant, you don't need to, which I thought was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
which left that company phoning around suppliers and talking to people and asking them, well, what do you do for us?
Yeah,
which, you know, you don't have to be Miss Marple to work out it ain't going to work. so it, it's
And if you do make a job function redundant, that means that that processes and those activities are no longer required. So unless you have come up with a different, more innovative process or something else,
and
it doesn't seem like none of those processes were actually documented in the first place. Which means, you know, it's all learning by osmosis. It's learning from one person, pass it on to the next, and this is the way we've always been doing it in the past. But it goes back to the core of building an organization, which is, you know, what is the end game, and then reverse engineering the task and the activities and the processes that need to be put in place, and what value those processes bring as a cost contributor, as a revenue contributor, as a support. And like you say, if you remove someone from the organization, say, thank you very much, your position is redundant, whatever input came into that person and whatever output came out of that person is no longer required. It's a bit hard to ask her, can you tell us what you were doing? Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
That's remarkable.
After the fact, right?
Yeah. I was just going to say that, yeah, it is truly remarkable that, you know, you just say, well, can you just write out that job description before you head out the door? And, just unacceptable.
When is the last time, Andy, did you see that you saw a job description actually, you know, being applied in the actual job? You know, what is it that you sign up is rarely what you end up doing anyway.
Yeah, no, very, very, very rarely. And it's interesting, you know, seeing, you know, jobs that are advertised these days, you know, they a lot of them, particularly in the procurement space, seem pretty generic. And there's only been about two or three very recently that I've seen where I suddenly thought, whoever's written this gets it. All the rest of them, it is the HR department have gone to the drawer and pulled out the previous person's and it's all generic. And to your point, Paul, that it, you know, it doesn't take into account all the things that they actually do. And yeah, we just end up, anybody who's looking to get a job ends up just confronted by the same list of things, and they don't really hold much weight, and they're nothing like the true job itself. So it's,
But going back to your point earlier, Eddie, and flipping that on its head, a much more successful side of that is that there's another procurement guy in the industry that really does know his business, and he knows our business and he knows everybody else's business, because he's made it his job to understand what everyone's doing, and his job has just blossomed, and it's got bigger and bigger in a declining market, because, you know, he's the guy that knows what's going on. He knows all the mills, he knows all the printers, and he knows all the publishers. And he's worked all around, he knows all the sides of it. And his department is actually growing in a much declined market. His department's growing because people are starting to lean on that knowledge and starting to use his department as an external procurement as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we're going to see going forward as well, is consolidation of publishing. You know, I know that you looked at it back in the day at EMAP, and I think publishers now, the figures are declining so much that they need to come together to buy together.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think not just in the publishing industry, but in other industries, I think that backroom purchasing leverage, and it's something that Christoph and I have spoken about, you know, when the competitive advantage is no longer to be found in your procurement process, the competitive advantage is found, you know, on the newsstand or in the high street shop or in the shopping malls. You know, it's, will people buy that product? That's the competitive leverage. You know, the fact that you're sourcing your materials, your raw materials or your services from the same place isn't where the battle's won or lost. Battle won or lost by who's got the best idea and then how well have they executed that. And once you've done that, it means from a procurement perspective, there's no reason why companies can't be more fluid in the way they share their sourcing. And yeah, in some instances, it can lead to question mark about, you know, building a sort of more monopolistic approach. But I don't think it will get to that stage. But you know, somebody, you know, and what we've seen in here in Australia in the printing industry, where there's really only two printers, you know, that's it, you know, and one of those is more seems to be more clearly winning that battle. And it will get to, you know, the maximum you'll get in most industries is one or two, and then there'll be the new entrants who might replace one of those if they're lucky. But you know, whether it's in clothing, you know, sportswear, whatever it might be, there's normally one or two big players. If people are a bit more collaborative on their procurement, again, it's that more strategic thinking piece. Yeah, that will help with sustainability, because you can collectively make better decisions on what industry standards look like, as opposed to
exactly
riding roughshod over them. So, yeah, I think there's so much to learn from these experiences, and you know, I certainly hope, from the point of view of everybody who's listening in, who listens in regularly to the procurement podcast, that. It's not just one linear approach. There's plenty of fluid ways of doing this thing.
Paul, I wanted to ask you another question about procurement and sustainability, or helping, you know, with the environment. What sort of initiatives have you been part of or led in that area?
The biggest one I'm involved in at the moment is about education and trying to get younger people to understand what we're doing, and that cutting down trees actually is a good thing. That we, you know, when you cut down a tree, we plant two or three more. And if we don't cut them down, and dying trees actually release carbon. So it's trying to get that message out. So we've been working with the government and with a school newspaper, believe it or not. It's really growing very quickly. And things on LinkedIn as well, that sort of thing. We're doing a much more marketing on the sustainability. But you know, the biggest thing for us is we own the forest. We've been doing this for generations. And sustainability isn't just about growing trees. It's about the environment around it, about the people that live there, about the animals. So SCA, we leave a fifth of the trees as natural forest, and it's just trying to educate people of how we do this, and you know, what parts of our production process create carbon binding, and which parts that we use carbon, that sort of thing, and being very open and transparent is the key to that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the truth, isn't it? Being open and transparent. It's funny that. If you're open and transparent in things in life, then the outcomes are usually a hell of a lot better. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be a message that cuts across.
No.
I think we're pretty much there, Christoph, don't you?
No. I really enjoyed the talk. I have a few. A few key points I noted down. It definitely talks, you know, a paradigm shift in terms of thinking about other ways to you know, to use whatever you're making. Even if a market is declining, there's nothing saying you cannot use it somewhere else. There is the importance of collaboration, not just with your suppliers but within your organization as well, which then has an impact on the strategic vision of the whole organization, and helping also everyone, you know, pretty much navigate within the organization to get a better understanding of their own individual specialty in terms of adding value to that organization. So I think, you know, the right culture at the top, like you say, Andy, everyone's got should read, you know, Who Moved My Cheese. That's a good start, but also reinforcing that the culture of collaboration, about strategic, you know, vision development, and just thinking out of the box, you know, regularly. I think it's super important. And the last thing I wanted to mention is, I think we mentioned that in one of our last podcasts, Andy, is the importance of simulating a downturn in the industry. I haven't seen any organization do that. If everything were to drop, what do we do next? And it's not when this happens that needs to, you know, that people should make decision. They should be planning for it. I think that's super, super important.
Absolutely.
Very.
Well, look, Paul, thank you so much for your time and for your insights. It's always good to catch up on these things, and really appreciate it very much. And best of luck for you with the coming months in what you need to do in the transition through to a different type of business, and obviously, you know, going forward, you know, very best wishes for you to find somewhere, which I'm sure you will, that will appreciate the insights and the value that you bring to your job.
Thank you. Yeah, it was nice to meet you, Christoph, as well.
Thanks very much for being on the podcast. Anyone wanting to send us questions about this podcast, feel free to email info@procurementpodcast.com. Or anyone want to suggest some speakers, please do so. Send an email to Andy and I, and we'll make sure to contact them. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day. Thank you for listening to the Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph. For more information, please visit our website, procurementpodcast.com, and feel free to email us your questions at info@procurementpodcast.com.